The Dow Jones Industrial Average, it's just a number, right?
Let him who hath understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666.
Well, actually, the number is 777, a historic point drop. A Capitol Hill revolt on the bailout draws blood on Wall Street. $1 trillion goes up in smoke. Billionaires eat losses. Millionaires eat tuna fish? Maybe. Hey, there's some good stuff for sale on eBay. Yachts for sale, yachts for sale, right here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 30th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, the anatomy of a Wall Street bailout plan that failed in the House and caused markets to plunge. A story about 10 states that have decided they're not going to wait for the federal government to take on greenhouse gases. Shining light on democracy, a story we'll explain, and a profile of Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, a man who went to Washington with great ambition. Those stories are coming up, at first a few headlines.
Call it presidential understatement.
As disappointing the vote with the United States Congress on the economic rescue plan.
President Bush had personally lobbied rank-and-file representatives who'd been wavering on the administration's financial bailout plan, but it wasn't enough. The proposal failed by 23 votes. The president is going to speak to the nation later on today, perhaps within the hour. Colorado Republican Marilyn Musgrave was one of the representatives who said she just couldn't vote for it.
I simply cannot stomach transferring that kind of money from the middle-class families to a bunch of Wall Street bankers whose avarice and greed put us in this situation in the first place.
Among reaction from leaders overseas, the Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd appealed to all sides in the American Congress to put aside their differences.
We would call, together with other friends and allies of the United States, on all parties in the U.S. Congress to put aside partisan differences. This is too big for the global economy and global financial markets to simply be captured by party politics.
And markets around the world appear to be stabilizing after yesterday's historic drop in U.S. markets. In Asia, markets closed flat, and European markets rebounded after dropping more than 2% at the opens. Trading on Moscow's stock markets was temporarily suspended by regulators after dropping sharply when they opened.
Not waiting for Congress, the Fed is scrambling to pump extra money into an emergency lending program for banks, and more than $330 billion is being pumped into so-called swap lines with foreign central banks. Oil prices have fallen to $95 a barrel in Asian trading. It was a steep drop yesterday, which probably explains the problems in Russia. And the S&P is set to open at 1106, but it's expected to open higher. The futures suggest a bounce back this morning. So, financial turmoil. Wall Street got declined on Capitol Hill yesterday. What's your decline story? And when did you take a stand on the bailout? 30% of Americans supposedly are for it, 70% against. What's your stand? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Were you for it or against it? Or maybe you were against it and then for it, or for it and then against it. We want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The yeas are 205, the nays are 228. The motion is not adopted.
That's the sound yesterday in the House of Representatives when they knew that the bailout plan from the administration had bombed out. The bailout plan did not pass, and the ripple effects were felt immediately on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 777 points, and that mark of the beast was more than matched by the decline in the S&P 500, 9% decline, nearly 9% decline. So with so much sentiment on Wall Street for this bailout and so much political sentiment in America against it. We couldn't be more fortunate than to have with us Chris Shays, Republican representative from Connecticut, who voted with the yeas, the 205 yeas, even though he was in the minority of his fellow Republicans. He joins us from Capitol or from Washington, D.C. Chris Shays, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
So this is not the first time you've been in a situation where you've supported the administration against your constituents. We could talk about foreign policy issues in the past, the Iraq War. It's made it very difficult for you politically. You did it again. How worried are you this morning?
Well, I'm just concerned that we're not playing Russian roulette. I mean, we have an economy. This isn't 1929, but it has the feeling of 1929. And, you know, it's just a bit reckless, it seems to me. But I know members were voting their conscience. This is what you call a legacy vote. This is the vote you have to carry with you the rest of your life. And you want to make sure it's the right vote and one that you can look back on and say, I did the right thing.
But, Congressman, is it really about consciousness, or is it a reflection also of what some of your constituents have been saying?
Well, I mean, my calls were 30-1 against but there were some districts that were 500-1. I mean, it's there is this feeling among some of my constituents and others that they would rather wait on bread lines than to see these financial tycoons, as they would describe them, not have to pay a penalty.
Well, do you believe they'll get their chance if Congress doesn't act? Will we actually go into something like a depression?
Well, who knows? I mean, I don't think we would go into a depression, but it would might be a very deep recession. But the bottom line is, this is something that we need to deal with, and we can do it. I did not think the bill was perfect. Obviously, no bill will be perfect. I had reservations. I didn't think, and I don't think $700 billion is enough. Having said that, I think we will ultimately get back all of that $700 billion and more in terms of selling these assets later, and in terms of the equity interest we get with the companies that have this protection. But there was the other side. I mean, there were members who were concerned, as I was, about why we weren't addressing the deposits in banks, insuring only up to $100,000 for depositors. That goes back to 1980, and you have businesses that can't do business without more than $100,000 in an account. And then there's also the issue of the capital adequacy. There's the view that if we focused on improving the capital adequacy of these banks, you would see the problem resolved.
Now, let's explain what that is. You're talking about relaxing credit requirements so that they don't have to post questionable securities on their balance sheet each quarter?
Well, that's called the mark to market, and there is the feeling that we are forcing companies to almost put their assets at fire sale prices. And, you know, as the bank has to contract, it's calling in its loans and just further exacerbating the problem. So, I mean, there could be some good that comes out of this. I think we will pass the bill either on Thursday or Friday. But wouldn't it be helpful, for instance, if the SEC dealt with this mark-to-market issue so that we didn't have to, force companies to bring mm-hmm. down their assets?
Congressman, how do you respond to the notion that what's lacking here is communication from the White House or from Republicans or Democrats who support this bailout to communicate the real need to their voters?
Well,
that there's a missing link that's enormous.
Well, there is a missing link, but, I mean, you are just part of that problem, and no disrespect, you call it a bailout. And it is not a bailout. A bailout implies that somehow we're giving something for nothing, and that people who don't deserve it are getting a benefit. What we're trying to do, so I agree that we need to communicate it, but do it better. This isn't about Wall Street. It's about Main Street. It's about people who have college savings seeing it disappear. It's about people with 401ks. It's about retirement funds. It's about businesses being able to get the dollars they need to fill the stocks in their shelves in their stores.
Understood, Congressman. But let me just take the position of your constituents, who I'm not going to take the rap for misleading. They're 30-1 against this bill for some good reasons. One of them could possibly be the fact that nothing in this bill forces banks to make those loans, to hire those people, to do those kinds of things that are going to protect those investments on Main Street. You can put all the money in the world into buying toxic securities, but if banks don't lend, and nothing the Fed has done up to this point is unfrozen the credit markets, if banks don't lend, we're in the same position we are with or without this bill.
Well, the answer that I would give you is that what we have now is we just don't have money moving from one place to another. It's like a big machine that's coming to a grinding halt. Companies need to make money. They're in the business of making money. If they stay static, they go out of business. So it's not logical to me that banks would not extend loans if they had money to loan.
But it's not logical that banks would give loans to people who can't pay them back. That's not logical either.
Well, and so why would we force them to?
But they did it on their own. Shouldn't they pay the penalty for that?
No, with all due respect, I mean, that's partly an argument I can't disagree with, but there's another part to the story. We were sending messages that banks should loan to people who had incredibly bad credit. We had the Federal Reserve of New England basically say that income would no longer be a factor in evaluating whether or not they should extend loans. I mean, so there was some craziness out there, and we all obviously had a role. We didn't have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac under the 1933 and 34 Act.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they basically securitized half of the $12 trillion that was out there.
Congressman, I think that there'd be overall agreement that there is lots and lots of problems,
right,
from, you know, for the borrower all the way up to the CEOs and to, you know, legislators and politicians. But let me ask you this.
Sure.
What do you think needs to happen now?
Well, first off, not to panic, because there's no reason to panic. The Senate wasn't going to vote on this bill until tomorrow anyway. I think I'm down in Washington. I think that's where we should be. We need 15 votes. It may be that some members will reconsider their vote. But there's also the possibility, and I think this is if the SEC dealt with its mark-to-market rule, just their changing that would bring in, you know, 50 votes. So they could do something. The administration could do something.
So you really think that some of these obstacles are just that simple?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I think this is a marginal call, and I do think, while they might not admit it, one or two members who voted no are a little concerned that they've caused, in part, the loss of $1 trillion.
Well, where does the panic come from, though? I mean, we've had the acquisition of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac by the federal government, essentially, the acquisition of AIG, essentially, by the federal government. We've had the largest bank failure in U.S. history with Washington Mutual, and now Wachovia, just averted failure by being acquired by Citigroup. I mean, every time the Fed step in at this point, the panic continues to persist. Even Henry Paulson said we're closer to the beginning than the ending in the housing correction.
Well,
why do you think this stops it?
Well, I don't think it stops it. I think it puts us in a path that heads us in a different direction. I mean, I acknowledge to you, I voted for a bill that I have three major questions with. So, you know, I think there are other things that clearly have to happen. But it's the first point is we can put this bill back together again without a lot of difficulty, I believe. So that's the first issue. And then the next issue is, what are the other things that follow? We had too many businesses, you know, playing and gambling with their shareholders' money. They simply had too high margin rates. We know that. And the fear is there because we realize there's not enough capital to back up what needs to be backed up.
Well, Congressman Shays, the fear is there both on Capitol Hill and on Wall Street. You've got a
right.
day to think about it, and you'll get back to work on Thursday.
Well,
Congressman,
I'm
appreciate
working,
thanks
I'm
for joining
today.
Us. Thanks. You're working today, exactly. We reached him in his office at Washington, D.C. Representative Christopher Shays, Republican of
Thank
Connecticut,
you.
Who voted, we should say, for the bailout yesterday.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We spoke to a very sober and concerned Republican Congressman Chris Shays this morning. He had to take a position yesterday in the House on the government's financial bailout package. He voted for it. How about you? For or against?
Andrea Black, I would love to have my student loans washed away into the sea of forgiveness. So if they can do that for me, I'm for this bailout. Thank you.
What'll it take to get your vote for the bailout? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Because what we're seeing is a battle between Wall Street and Washington. And so far, Wall Street does not appear to be winning. The question really is, with barely 30% of Americans supporting this plan, how could it be a surprise to Wall Street that this would not go down to defeat? The accusations from the Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson, and other economic policymakers is that the credit markets are frozen and there is very little to be done until a bailout is passed. Henry Paulson does have some tools in his toolkit, though.
Our toolkit is substantial but insufficient. Therefore, I will continue to work with congressional leaders to find a way forward.
Finding a way forward, that was Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson speaking yesterday. David Weiss is the chief economist for Standard & Poor's. David, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
So in the wake of all this stalling on Capitol Hill and the going back to the drawing board that presumably is going to need to be done, what can the Fed and the Treasury do now to free up credit markets? I read yesterday that $100 billion in commercial paper has just vanished from the market, and that's got to affect businesses all over the world, really.
Well, there's just no way to get loans right now because banks are caught short because they don't have the capital anymore to make the loans. The securitization markets are frozen up. No banks are willing to lend money to other banks, much less anybody else.
So what can the Fed do to turn this around in lieu of Congress taking any action at all?
Well, to be blunt, it's already done just about everything it can do. It's tried to put in these liquidity facilities to get money into the banks. It's tried to buy up as much of the paper as possible to try to keep things moving. It succeeded in sort of a minimal way, but, you know, I think they're running out of tools.
What I'd like to do is empower people who spend a lot of time looking at maybe market numbers to forget about the market for a minute. And what are the chief indicators of the health of this credit market? Because it is much larger than the stock market. It's probably much more important to the Main Street economy. What do you watch for to determine whether the credit markets are frozen or liquid?
Well, generally, you look for what banks are paying to lend to each other, and those levels are very high. They're still paying about 2 percentage points above the federal funds rate, which is normally pretty much what banks pay to lend to each other. You're now paying about 6%.
Wow.
And those kinds of levels are, about 4%. I'm sorry, it was 6% last week. And it's those levels are very high, and it makes it very difficult for banks to get the liquidity in that they need to make loans.
Now, that's the so-called LIBOR rate, right?
Yeah, this is the difference between LIBOR and Fed funds, or they also use the TED spread, which is the difference between the LIBOR and the Treasury bond yield, and that's running even higher right now.
Now, another indicator is the amount of interest that the Treasury is getting for bonds. I mean, the yield on the Treasury bond hit at a certain point yesterday, it seemed on the one-month bond, zero, which, if I'm not mistaken, means that if you put inflation into the mix, banks are paying the federal government to just keep their money safe rather than lend it out?
Yeah, basically, banks are willing to accept nothing in order to get a Treasury security, which is amazing. It's only happened 3 times in history, the last time being World War II, when there just wasn't much of anything else to buy.
I mean, that's the equivalent of a bank basically taking the cash home in a shopping cart and putting it in a mattress, right?
Yeah, remember, it's not just banks buying these Treasuries, though. It's individuals, it's money market funds, everybody. Yeah, they're saying, look, we want safety so much that you don't even have to pay us anything to take our money. Just promise to give it back.
All right, so Lehman Brothers spent week after week after week at the discount window, we were told, when the Fed eased up the ability to get money from directly from the Fed if you were an investment bank, something they'd never done before, and it still didn't save Lehman Brothers. How come the federal government, which has something on the order of $900 billion at the Federal Reserve to play with, and they can actually print money as well, why can't this money be used to loosen things up?
The basic problem, the Federal Reserve can lower the cost for the Treasury to borrow money. They can lower the federal funds rate. But that doesn't directly affect the rate that banks have to pay to each other or the banks have to charge to everybody else. This is very similar to the problem that Japan got into in the early 90s, where the banks took big losses, their capital base was eroded, they couldn't make loans. And even though the Bank of Japan took interest rates down to zero, they still couldn't get loans out into the market, and the Japanese economy was stagnant for 10 years.
For 10 years. But I mean, why that's really the scary part.
Why doesn't it help banks and the rates that they charge one another to borrow money if there's more money in the system?
Well, there's more money in the system, but it tends to flow only into the extremely safe assets, which basically means U.S. Treasuries. So Treasury rates go down to zero. And then you hit a limit because it's hard to push on that string any harder. Plus, banks need a certain amount of capital in order to make loans, both by regulation and just by reality. They don't have that capital right now to expand their lending base.
Well, let's elaborate on two points before we go. The Japanese analogy was also a bubble that burst when real estate in Japan burst. So it's similar to what's going on in the United States. And the 10-year-long recovery is actually pretty sobering. Do you think the fact that this is a real estate bubble that began all of this in the U.S., again, bodes ill for a speedy recovery?
Yeah, in Japan it was mostly commercial real estate rather than residential, but even residential home prices are now 25% below where they were 10 years ago. And the stock market's trading at one-third what it was 20 years ago.
Wow.
So it's not a good analogy to make. I don't think we'll make, you know, I think we've got more tools to fix this than the Japanese were willing to use, but you know, they pulled out all the stops once they got into that trap.
Now, the other thing is, if you talk to Ron Paul or people who are, you know, kind of monetarist radicals, they say that, you know, what the economy needs is a standard to back up this paper, and that what the turmoil is that's going on right now is the economy looking for something of real value to price risk and borrowing rates and all that sort of thing. Is that what we're seeing here, that the market looked for American real estate as the kind of basic value whereby everything could be priced from, and now with that gone, they're looking for something else and they're not really finding it?
Well, I think that's simplistic. The fact is that they're looking for, they need a standard of value. The U.S. dollar has provided that standard of value, but now they're not sure getting their money back. And obviously, if they're not sure getting their money back, they don't want to shove any more cash over here.
David Weiss explains it all for you, chief economist for Standard & Poor's. I love that guy.
No, he's great, but he's not terribly reassuring at this moment because
it doesn't we're not
seem
as bad
like
as Japan. That's
the market even knows what it needs or wants to settle things down.
Uncertainty. It's our trademark here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. You might say Wall Street's Capitol Hill credit card got declined yesterday. Do you care?
Yes, my name is George Golub. It's Tuesday, and I'm calling from New York City. The reaction all over the country to the failed bailout is perhaps the right one. It was never explained to the people how it was going to help the people.
Have you been declined in asking for money? Wall Street didn't get its $700 billion, but what are your stories of being declined? The credit markets, we're told, are frozen. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There are certainly other things going on this week. While those questions about leadership are plaguing the U.S. Capitol this week, environmental advocates say a group of 10 states are showing great leadership in tackling global warming. It's a coalition called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, formed without any input from the federal government. And the idea is to reduce emissions, which is a trend. This idea of regional coalitions is a trend spreading across the country. David Biello, an associate editor at Scientific American, joins us now with more. Good morning, David, and welcome.
Good morning to you.
Explain to us the cap and trade greenhouse gas reduction program.
Well, these are so-called market-based mechanisms, which basically address the problem by setting an overall cap and then giving allowances to polluters to meet said cap, and they can reduce their emissions by trading the allowances amongst themselves. That allows them to do it in the lowest cost way.
So it's basically like trading chips, and it certainly creates incentives not only for polluters, but for anyone who's concerned about emissions, right?
That's right. Pretty much anybody can participate, which is the good thing, I guess, about a free market. If you want to try to help reduce our CO2 emissions, you can go on and buy an allowance and just hold on to it, and that will remove that one ton of CO2 emissions from the wider market and mean that coal-fired power plants in the Northeast region won't be enabled to emit that ton.
The 10 states involved include Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New Hampshire, New York, Rhode Island, and Vermont. The cap, it sounds like a big number, 188 million tons is the allowance for each polluter. Can you explain that, and will that number change at all?
That number will change. In fact, it already has. It's based on an estimate from 2005 of what emissions would be like over the next 10 years. So the goal of this program is to reduce emissions 10% below what they would otherwise be by 2019. And unfortunately for the planners of this market, emissions haven't grown as fast as they were expecting. So the cap, which is 188 million tons, as you mentioned, is actually a little bit higher than actual emissions at present. So it won't be, at least as of today, bringing down emissions too strongly.
Well, David, one of the issues on the cap and trade program is that the program really depends on this market setting a price, a real price for carbon emissions. First of all, what is the price based on the early trading now? And secondly, how close is that price of a ton of carbon to what you believe scientifically is the actual cost to the environment of that emission?
Well, to answer the second part first, it's probably nowhere near the actual embedded cost to the environment of emitting a ton of CO2. We are, by most estimates, way ahead of where we want to be as far as restraining those emissions. We're ahead of the UN Intergovernmental Panel's on climate change projections, worst-case scenario projections, for where we would be at this point. And they made those projections just last year, and we're already ahead of them. But the price as of today is $3.07. That's $3 more than a ton of carbon dioxide cost in this country even last week. It's not anywhere near what Europeans are paying for carbon, which is, I believe, last time I checked, roughly $38.
Oh, wow. And
that's because that's more of a strenuous market. As I mentioned, the cap here isn't quite as tough as people expected it to be because thanks to various financial crises and economic downturns, growth hasn't been what was kind of anticipated back in 2005 when this cap was set.
And so what are some of the lessons that have, as you just mentioned one, but what are some of the other lessons that you've learned in this early experimentation or those who are involved in the cap and trading?
Well, what's most interesting, I think, about REGGIE, as it's affectionately known, is that this is the first attempt to actually auction off these allowances. So in the past, governments who set up these markets had simply given to power plant owners the right to pollute. So let's say you emitted 30 tons of CO2 from your power plant, you would be given 30 allowances by the government and then, attempt to address your emissions. Instead of doing that, RGGI is auctioning off a portion of those allowances and putting the proceeds from that auction, which came to about $38 million towards renewable energy and energy efficiency programs. So it's kind of a win-win as far as CO2 goes. You're reducing emissions from the actual coal-fired power plants, mm-hmm. and you're also funding programs that will reduce energy demand and therefore carbon dioxide emissions.
David Biello, thank you. Thank you for laying out that experiment in motion. He is an associate editor at Scientific American who focuses on energy and the environment. Now we're going to get the latest headlines of the morning from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Thank you very much. Coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush is set to address the nation in just a few minutes' time on the failed bank bailout plan this morning. The failure came despite furious personal lobbying by President Bush and House leaders. U.S. stocks are headed for a partial rebound a day after logging their steepest losses in two decades. That's according to Morning Futures Trading. European stock exchanges are still digesting the shock from yesterday's drop. European markets dropped sharply at the open, but later recovered most losses. Barack Obama released a statement this morning that urges Congress to get the financial bailout plan passed. Obama's pleas come a day after John McCain accused his opponent of encouraging the partisan fighting that caused the plan to fail. Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he's asked the King of Saudi Arabia to help start peace talks with the Taliban. And a federal prosecutor has been appointed to look at the 2006 firings of 9 U.S. attorneys. The Justice Department released a report yesterday suggesting the dismissals were politically motivated. And just got some figures in for the presidential debate that happened on Friday on PBS with Jim Lehrer. The audience figures were 53 million people, which sounds like a lot.
It does sound like a lot.
It does, like a lot of people watched that debate. But 10 million more watched John Kerry debate with President Bush in 2004. And the ratings were down, apparently, because John McCain didn't decide until quite late in the day when he's actually going to turn up. And then Friday night viewing is just very slow anyway. Mm.
And we are going to be viewing the president, who will be speaking in the next few minutes, so we'll be taking that live. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
We are waiting for the president to speak in the next 2 or 3 minutes. The president has announced a live address from the White House to presumably react to what happened yesterday in the House of Representatives. The bailout package did not pass. Markets reacted swiftly. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 7%. The S&P 500, perhaps a more critical gauge of what's going on in the market, lost nearly 9%. Joining us now is David Herzenhorn, New York Times reporter who covers Capitol Hill and has been on this story of the bailout package on the Hill all along. David, thanks for joining us.
Day and night, I think is about right. Right, David? You've been on the story day and night.
Day and night, yeah.
That's correct. So is this quickly before we go to the president, is this a bully pulpit speech that's basically addressed to the nation at large, or is this more lobbying directly at Capitol Hill, which gets back to work on Thursday?
No, my guess is that he is going to try to talk to the nation at large, because the nation at large is what's driving the members of Congress and how they're voting. You know, it's 5 weeks from today until Election Day. And I think he realizes that at this point, you know, they're not going to follow his lead necessarily. He's not running for anything. He doesn't have his job on the line. So what you'll see is the president perhaps trying to help the public better understand why this is necessary. I can't imagine that anything he could say in a speech would be more powerful than what he was saying when he was making phone calls to individual members of Congress yesterday. We know he made at least a dozen of those at the White House. There were top officials making 40, 50 calls like that. And you had several congressional members who said, thanks, Mr. President, I hear you, I'll think about it. And then they turned around and voted no.
We just spoke to Representative Christopher Shays of Connecticut, and he was saying that in his office he was getting calls 30-1 against the package, and that he knew some of his fellow congressmen and women were getting calls 500-1. So they're certainly under a lot of pressure from voters.
National polls say 30% of Americans are the small minority, relatively small minority, that support this plan. We want to mention once again, we're going to go live to the White House, where the president is expected to address this issue, as David Herzenhorn was just pointing out. We also want to remind our stations that we're going to be going through the break in 1 minute and taking the president's remarks through the break, so that will warn those stations. Again, the president expected to address the nation. We'll get a chance to watch the futures market react to the president attempting to reassure the president. And he's stepping to the podium now. We go to the White House to talk with President Bush.
Unfortunately, the measure was defeated by a narrow margin. I'm disappointed by the outcome, but I assure our citizens and citizens around the world that this is not the end of the legislative process. Producing legislation is complicated, and it can be contentious. It matters little what a path a bill takes to become law. What matters is that we get a law. We're at a critical moment for our economy, and we need legislation that decisively addresses the troubled assets now clogging the financial system, helps lenders resume the flow of credit to consumers and businesses, and allows the American economy to get moving again. I recognize this is a difficult vote for members of Congress. Many of them don't like the fact that our economy has reached this point, and I understand that. But the reality is that we're in an urgent situation, and the consequences will grow worse each day if we do not act. Legislation considered would ultimately cost the taxpayer far less than the $700 billion, because the government would be purchasing troubled assets and selling them once the market recovers. It is likely that many of the assets would go up in value over time. Ultimately, we expect that much, if not all, of the tax dollars we invest will be paid back. As much as we might wish the situation were different, our country is not facing a choice between government action and the smooth functioning of the free market. We're facing a choice between action and the real prospect of economic hardship for millions of Americans, for the financial security of every American. Congress must act. My administration will continue to work closely with leaders of both parties on Capitol Hill. I appreciate their determined efforts. While Congress is out today for the Jewish holiday, my administration will be talking to congressional leaders today about how we can move legislation forward when members begin returning to the Capitol tomorrow. Our economy is depending on decisive action from the government. The sooner we address the problem, the sooner we can get back on the path of growth and job creation. This is what elected leaders owe the American people, and I'm confident we'll deliver. Thank you.
President Bush speaking from the White House, reacting to the failure on the part of the House of Representatives yesterday to pass the bailout plan. And as we were talking before the president walked in there in front of a number of reporters, that the mission for President Bush was to address the issue that constituents of lawmakers on Capitol Hill are overwhelmingly against this bailout plan, one of the reasons why it failed. The question to David Herzenhorn of The New York Times, do you think he accomplished anything there, the president?
Well, I think we got the answer to your earlier question, which is that he wasn't necessarily speaking to Congress or to the American people, but to the markets, trying to reassure Wall Street and markets around the world that, in fact, this process is not anywhere near over, that they're very intent on coming back and reaching some sort of compromise that will put this rescue effort in motion. I don't know that there was any better explanation for folks of why they should, you know, start making phone calls to their members of Congress and change their tune, to turn around and say, you know what, I was wrong, I understand it better now, go ahead, support this, and you've got my vote in November. That's the kind of message that certainly the members of Congress are looking to hear. And when you talk about Chris Shays, he was on the floor of the House yesterday expressing concerns, but also saying that it was clear that something was needed for the economy. He represents a district in Connecticut, obviously, that depends a lot on Wall Street jobs. There are lots of his constituents who work in New York City. And so if he's hearing that kind of negative reaction from the folks he represents, you know it's being heard around the country. And folks just might not be as interested in the $1.2 trillion lost from the portfolios of wealthy investors. Obviously, it's not just the wealthy. It's pension funds, retirement funds of everyday Americans. But that, I don't know that that message will resonate. We'll have to see.
Yeah, David, I'm actually surprised. He only spoke for a very few minutes. And part of what he said is he called the economy an urgent situation, that the consequences grow each day if the government doesn't act, that the economic damage could be painful and lasting. How would that be motivational, either to voters, to American taxpayers, or to anyone on Capitol Hill? Where do you think he was going with that?
I think he was trying to reassure the markets, and that's why you got a sort of a brief, contained speech where he said, "Look, we're gonna figure out a way forward and get this done." I think for the public, that $700 billion figure is way too big to understand. It's just too much.
Well, the president tried to elucidate that number, and it's interesting the number he chose. He said that the $800 billion is big, but the $1.2 trillion that went down yesterday, went up in smoke yesterday, is much, much bigger. It's actually not much, much bigger. It is bigger, but it's not much, much bigger. We should note that the market's reaction to the president was a slight uptick in the futures on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, so unclear what the market's reaction even is at this point.
Right. I mean, well, remember, the $1.2 trillion is just one day's losses. I mean, if we end up in a prolonged economic downturn, presumably those losses will amount substantially over a long stretch of time. But, I do think that maybe not in this sort of a speech, this might not be the place for it, but at some point over the next few days, before members of Congress, before the House comes back and maybe tries to vote on this again, there will need to be some messaging to the American public.
Right, right. David, that seems to be a glaring issue. And when we did talk to Christopher Shays, congressman, I did ask him about that. And he said that we are part of the problem, the media, in that we keep calling it a bailout. But essentially, bailout, rescue plan, economic program, whatever the heck you want to call it, the bottom line is they're talking about a whole lot of money, and no one's exactly sure if there will be any return on that money to anyone, whether it be the government or the taxpayers.
But it's also important to understand that there's more likely to be a return on that money than if the government, say, went out and spent $700 billion to pay down a portion of everybody's mortgage, right? At that point, you're paying money back to the banks, and you're never getting it back. So there does need to be an explanation of why this is necessary, why it could be a lot worse for everyday Americans. Now, I understand our job in the media is to help people understand this and to understand, what's going on out there. And one of the ways I've described it is, everybody's sitting at home working on their computer, and, somewhere in an office far away, there's a technician looking at a server and seeing, lights that are blinking and knowing, uh-oh, everybody's about to go down.
Right,
but,
right.
Nobody back home notices that.
But it is kind of abstract, and I guess perhaps the most difficult to understand is how the economy has gone in a few short weeks from being something we understood to be based on a kind of a free market faith and credit arrangement between private sector banks and depositors and pensioners and all that sort of thing, to something that the federal government is heavily involved in, from Fannie and Freddie to AIG to the bank acquisitions. It's a very, very different world now, and I think people are basically putting on the brakes and saying, hold on a minute. And the question really is, has the president addressed that issue? David Herzenhorn, thanks so much for joining us. Much more to take a look at as Congress gets to work today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The president has just spoken, reacting to the market sell-off yesterday and the failure by the House of Representatives to pass the bailout plan. But we're going to get other headlines from Femi Okeh before we go.
Thanks, John. It's just coming up to 5 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush has just made a live address in the last 15 minutes. He said that Congress must act. Our economy is dependent on decisive action from the government. And the president says that he's confident that Congress will deliver. Meanwhile, Congress is off today for the Jewish New Year, and the break might give everyone some cooling off time. Congressional leaders and White House officials will be trying to find some common ground to get the bailout plan passed. Oil prices fell to around $95 a barrel in Asia trading today after plummeting overnight. The drop comes amid worries that the financial crisis would reduce demand for oil. The demand for gasoline is high in parts of the southeast for the third week in a row. A hurricane-induced gasoline shortage has hit Atlanta particularly hard, along with Nashville and western North Carolina. A federal prosecutor from Connecticut will pursue criminal charges against the Bush administration officials tied to the firing of nine U.S. attorneys in 2006. Nora Dehaney is a 17-year veteran of the Justice Department. Pirates holding a Ukrainian ship off the coast of Somalia are surrounded by U.S. Navy destroyers and a Russian warship. A Pentagon official says this morning that the military believes that three pirates were killed in a gunfight among themselves on the ship they hijacked last week. The cargo includes 33 Soviet-made tanks, military hardware and weapons. And Lieutenant Nathan Christensen explains why the Navy is staying so close to the hijacked ship.
Our mission here is to ensure the safety of the crew, to not allow the offloading of the dangerous cargo, and make sure that the vessel itself can return to legitimate shipping.
Negotiations are continuing with the pirates to release the crew and the cargo. And that's a look at your news for this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And recapping, the markets are scheduled to open in about 33 minutes from now. The early reaction to the president's speech about 10 minutes ago, reacting to the failure by the House of Representatives to pass the bailout package, it seems to be mute. There is not much of a reaction. The futures are looking for a positive bounce as the markets open at 9:30. But so far, we'll just have to wait and see. We're always on at the Takeaway, of course. Election Day, less than 6 weeks away. We've got you covered on all that. Go to vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
And we've actually got some new tools for following the candidates, an Electoral College prediction tracker. Very interesting. It incorporates all of the latest information on the web. Check that out. Also, video from new voices across the country and a lot of other things.
And voters have new ways of following the candidates, too. Did you vote for or against the bailout? That's a new tool that we didn't even create. That was created by the House of Representatives. We're following the $700 billion bailout plan that was defeated yesterday, and the after effects we'll be reporting on all this morning.
We want to know what you think about the ever-developing economy. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Here's your takeaway for today.
There is this feeling among some of my constituents and others that they would rather wait on bread lines than to see these financial tycoons, as they would describe them, not have to pay a penalty.
The agony of Connecticut Republican Chris Shays. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
So, Congressman Barney Frank, no bailout, markets tank. What's the story?
Here's the story. There's a terrible crisis affecting the American economy. We have come together on a bill to alleviate the crisis. And because somebody hurt their feelings, they decide to punish the country.
So please stop hurting my feelings. That's not a nice thing to do.
That's right. Sticks and stones will break our bones, but hurt feelings are the end of the world, apparently. Wall Street winces through a nearly 9% decline. No bailout, no revote. Barney needs a hug. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 30th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Lots happening today. President Bush just addressed the nation. We're talking in the last 15 minutes. This following an historic drop yesterday in the U.S. financial markets. The Dow futures are up more than 150 points this morning, and markets around the globe are adjusting as Congress and the president scramble to figure out their next move after the House rejected the Bush administration's $700 billion Wall Street financial plan. We'll have lots on that. And the tainted milk scandal in China, it widens. And we'll take a look at the language of evangelical voters. Those stories are coming up, but here's some headlines.
A few moments ago, President Bush addressed the nation. He had marching orders for Congress and for the American people.
The sooner we address the problem, the sooner we can get back on the path of growth and job creation. This is what elected leaders owe the American people.
The speech was all about restoring confidence in the bailout plan, which the House of Representatives failed to pass yesterday. Congress will pick up discussion on the measure on Thursday after a break for the Jewish New Year.
On the campaign trail yesterday, John McCain blamed Barack Obama and other Democrats for the measure's failure. Barack Obama echoed the president's call for calm.
It's important for the American public and for the markets to stay calm because things are never smooth in Congress, and to understand that it will get done.
And markets around the world appear to be stabilizing after yesterday's historic drop in U.S. markets. In Asia, markets closed flat, and European markets rebounded after dropping more than 2% at the opens.
The Fed is scrambling to rally congressional support. It's tried to stabilize world markets by pumping an extra $150 billion into an emergency lending program that it doesn't need congressional approval for, and also $330 billion in so-called swap lines with foreign central banks. And a federal prosecutor has been appointed to take a look at the 2006 firing of nine U.S. attorneys after a Justice Department report released a scathing report yesterday suggesting the firings were politically motivated. Oil prices have spiked downward to $95 a barrel in Asian trading.
For or against? That's the question we're asking.
Take
you.
A stand.
For or against the bailout rescue emergency plan, whatever you want to call it, that was defeated yesterday by the House. What do you think Congress needs to do next? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Or think of it this way. Wall Street got its Capitol Hill credit card declined yesterday. One of you had a decline. Tell us your decline stories in this credit freeze environment. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Wall Street markets are set to open in less than 25 minutes. It will be the first market reaction to the president, who spoke to the nation about 22 minutes ago and urged Congress to pass the bailout plan, which failed in the House yesterday, and tried to reassure Americans that, in fact, the cost of inaction is greater than whatever cost there would be in passing the plan. We should note that a widely watched housing index just released in the last few minutes shows that home prices in America have dropped at the fastest annual rate ever in July. That is a record. Joining us now to talk about the political implications of both the president's speech and the idea that Congress is going to wait for several days before anything happens on this bailout plan is Richard Wolff, Newsweek's senior White House correspondent. Richard, you heard the president's speech. I gather he was addressing not only Congress, but the nation at large. What do you think the message was, and how likely is this to reassure the what we appear to see as a 30 to 70% lopsided lack of support for the bailout plan around people in the United States?
Well, there were two messages here, and neither of them were new. One is to the markets, this process is messy. Legislation will happen, and so be calm. And the message to members of Congress is that the alternatives are worse. You don't like this legislation. Nobody likes having to do it. But the possibility of it not happening
it could well lead to economic disaster, and what we saw in the markets yesterday was just a taste of it. Having said that, because he's made these arguments before and the legislation went down so badly yesterday, it's not clear that it's going to be enough just repeating what the president has said before.
Yeah, Richard, that was my question. I was a bit surprised that he didn't present some other argument for why he believes this particular bailout package is the one that is going to help the U.S. economy and therefore the world economy.
Well, the problem here is that there's no alternative. You can sweeten it in some way. You can add measures that members of Congress can take back to their unhappy voters and say, look, we got a better deal. But the underlying dynamic really doesn't change. The markets need extra money, or at least the promise of extra money, for some reassurance, because this is all about confidence. And the dynamic doesn't change in that we are so close to an election, and that's an impossible time to do what is controversial and complex piece of new legislation. It's election politics that is really driving this, as well as the markets. And faced with a market decline or losing a seat, lawmakers choose to avoid losing a seat.
Although in 2004, the president said something which I suspect has come back to haunt him at this moment, and I'm wondering if it crossed his mind as he was speaking to the nation. After the victory in 2004, the president said he had won an enormous amount of political capital that he intended to spend. 4 years later, it appears that he has none of that capital left, and there's almost no real persuasive power that he has other than a kind of a Hail Mary, which is what, quite frankly, that speech looked like to me.
You know, what's fascinating about President Bush's second term is that 4 months after he promised to everyone that he had political capital, he obviously had none. And the same people who caused his second term to go down almost immediately in terms of what he was able to do are the same people who blocked his plans this week. That's to say, House Republicans, this ideological group of true blue conservatives, or rather true red conservatives, are the ones who are frustrating him now. They stopped him on a whole range of things, especially immigration, but on spending plans. These are the people who felt that they got rolled in the first term on things like a prescription drug benefit for Medicare, on growing government, on the Department of Homeland Security. And they are coming back here and saying, we represent the future of the party, not you. So this is a debate that has been going on for a very long time, and it's been deeply frustrating. Whether or not John McCain could do it as president, whether he could control this group of people, is an open question, given what we've seen over the last few days.
Let's get to McCain in a second, but just to back up to what President Bush faces now, does he go back to the drawing board? Do they come up with a different proposal? Does he sit on the leadership on Capitol Hill to hammer out whatever remaining obstacles are left? What can he do?
Well, they can add certain things that will just attract just enough votes. Barack Obama is out with a plan which has also bubbled up through Congress to more than double, from $100,000 to $250,000, the amount that's insured by the FDIC in regular deposit accounts. That would give some people some cover. Remember that although I just talked about House Republicans, there was a combined sort of consensus yesterday between conservative Republicans in the House and also liberal Democrats in the House, people who didn't like this plan. So the question is, could you just peel off a dozen or two dozen votes, or do you have to do something that gets you another 100 votes? It's going to be very hard to do that. But as I said, increasing the amount of insurance in these bank accounts may be one way to do that. But the other elements of it, the main thrust of this package, which is to say, giving this broad authority to Treasury Secretary to buy up these so-called troubled assets, these mortgage-backed securities, that's not going to change. There is no other plan.
You know, it's interesting because it seems as though a giant arc is kind of closing in terms of presidential history here, and I wonder if you can follow me on this. It's not too convoluted, I promise. Maybe it takes more of a Harry Truman to pass a plan like this so close to an election, somebody who comes from Main Street America, rather than George Bush, who got elected on his corporate creds, and Henry Paulson, who's the Secretary of the Treasury because he was once chairman of Goldman Goldman Sachs. John McCain is, you know, talking about maybe he doesn't know that much about the economy, but he's a successful manager with military sort of corporate style. That role is discredited in Washington all of a sudden, and there isn't one to replace it yet.
Well, that's a good point, and it could be the president's resume, but it also, I think you could fault his immediate response here. It took him about 10 days for the president to come out and talk in a credible, serious way about this crisis, which was way too long. And when he did talk about it, he didn't really sort of get out the charts, the flip charts and the stick, and say, look, this is how this happened, and this is why we're here, and we all share responsibility. So what's happened is that for a week or two, people have been able to say it's all the fault of the Wall Street folks. Well, obviously they bear a huge degree of the blame here, but in the end there were consumers out there, homeowners, speculators, people who were just taking out credit, and we all were at the party. So, you know, it takes a president who has credibility, who is looking to the future, who can see this crisis unfold, to get out there early and shape perceptions, and that just didn't happen.
Well, it sounds as though you're describing this as a kind of a financial Katrina, in that you've got a member of the government fronting for the administration, and the president is sort of in the shadows. Do you think this is kind of a Katrina too?
There is certainly, in terms of the delayed response, there are parallels, but I'm not sure that this administration was slow to understand what was going on. The problem is that Paulson doesn't come from Washington. He is a Wall Street figure. He doesn't have the political or the communication skills to drive home his message. And when you think that he had to, albeit in jest, drop onto his knees last week in front of Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, and beg her to pass this, it just tells you that there wasn't enough work done with Congress to bring them along here. And again, that's been a feature of this second term, whether it's on Katrina or on Iraq. If you keep going my way or the highway, and you adapt late in the process, then at some point the other side, in this case Congress, starts to adopt the same tactics, and that's exactly what they've done.
So you talked about, you know, maybe the tactic here is to try to peel off 12 congressmen to make this work. There's also talk of having the Senate go first. Quickly, before we go, are there any waivers? Can you identify six lawmakers who might be convincible at this point? I don't see any.
In the House, they're looking at members of the Financial Services Committee who may be under pressure from their own contacts in the financial services industry. Remember, this isn't a hypothetical crisis. Banks are collapsing on a daily basis. So someone with some experience in the financial services industry may be vulnerable there for some pressure. They're also looking at some swing states that have also suffered disproportionately from the collapse in housing, places like Florida, Nevada. So they're really focusing on points of pressure there, and they may be able to pick off the votes. If they don't do that, then you're looking at individual bailouts of individual banks, and not enough money to go around.
All right, Richard Wolff is Newsweek's senior White House correspondent, talking about the reaction, if there is any, and we're going to see it all day today, to the president speaking to the nation about the bailout that failed to pass the House yesterday. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We can continue to cover the U.S. financial crisis and, of course, are looking to the markets, which open in just under 10 minutes. See what the reaction is to President Bush's words in the last hour or so. But it's not lost on politicians in Washington who are wrangling through this financial crisis that There's an election coming up less than 5 months away. And so joining us to look at a very important group of the evangelicals is evangelical leader and author Lisa Sharon Harper. She just wrote a book called Evangelical Does Not Equal Republican or Democrat. Lisa, good morning and nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Among other things that we're going to talk about, first we're going to think a little bit about some of the language that you say you can clearly see in the way that Republicans particularly campaign, code words that are very attractive to the evangelical community. You want to explain a little bit to us about that?
Sure. Actually, you know, Republicans, let's go back a little bit. Evangelicals, we are not associated with any one party. We are not connected to a party. We are a religious group, and actually to align with a political party is to commit idolatry, actually according to our faith. Political parties don't exist to further the kingdom of God. They exist to further themselves. So when the Republican Party really courts evangelicals, they do use buzzwords. They use words like faith and axis of evil. And for example, when Palin did her speech at the convention, the Republican convention, she talked about she set up a situation where Obama was the adversary, and she set up a situation where he was the adversary of justice, and John McCain was the one who actually put forward justice because he was the war hero. These are the kinds of things. It's that adversarial relationship is necessary in order to galvanize a collective action movement.
We actually have a bit of sound from Sarah Palin in her interview with Katie Kirks. Let's listen, and then you can tell us what you think.
Okay.
It's very important when you consider even national security issues with Russia, as Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America, where do they go? It's Alaska. It's just right over the border.
So rearing his head.
Yes, exactly. That's a great example. I mean, basically.
So that incomprehensible phrase is actually very much understandable to some.
Oh, well, it's a phrase that sets up an adversarial relationship. Mm-hmm. We now see it's actually ominous. He's rearing his head over the borders and
struggle between good and evil, kind of thing.
Exactly, exactly. And the thing about it is that Palin is a daughter of the religious right. I mean, she grew up with the religious right. She supported Pat Robertson in his bid for the presidency. And John McCain knew that in order to win this election, he needed to galvanize a collective action movement. And no one does collective action like the religious right.
I was going to say, you started off saying that the evangelicals are not automatically aligned with a party, but the Republican Party has done a really good job of courting evangelicals, but not only that, representing some of the social issues that evangelicals care about most.
That's true. And they've done it through framing and themes. So what they do is they frame the situation through language, symbols, images that really do connect to evangelicals in their everyday faith life. So, for example, the axis of evil is a really big one, you know, from Bush. But even with Palin in her convention speech, she set up this adversarial relationship with Obama by talking about him as one who doesn't respect, you know, the small town person. Well, you know, the small town person who connects with her is going to be most often, it's going to be the fundamentalist, the evangelical. Well, he doesn't respect their faith. She even mentioned that, I think, at one point in her speech. So when
you say it's not lost on the Democrats, or at least not this time around, that you sent some of that same language even when Obama is speaking.
Well, it's a typical political thing. You have to and both of them are trying to galvanize collective action movements. You have to set up an injustice frame. You have to set up an adversarial frame, and you have to use themes that connect with the era.
Here's a bit of Obama. Tell me what you think of this. Mm-hmm.
This is a final verdict on 8 years of failed economic policies promoted by George Bush, supported by Senator McCain.
So that rings familiar to you in terms of the framework you're talking about?
Exactly, because what he's done is he has connected, well, he's set up the obvious adversary is George Bush. George Bush, it's his fault. But McCain voted with George Bush 90% of the time. So therefore, McCain then becomes, by proximity, the adversary.
Is that to say that evangelicals don't like the idea of compromise and consensus, these sort of core values of democracy, that they're pretty much looking for either or, black and white, good and evil?
Yes, it is to say that. And I think that what's interesting is that when you look at the themes that have like surfaced in these two campaigns, the difference between the two candidates is striking. What you see in McCain is you see a very, very definite and old school appeal to the America First theme and an appeal to the self-reliance, the theme of self-reliance. These are two huge themes within evangelical culture. I think that's where you find it more than anything, the connection.
Last question, Lisa. Who are you supporting? You want to share that with us?
No. What I will say this, and this is what I say to the people. I am executive director of New York Faith and Justice here in the city, and I, you know, wrote this book, Evangelical Does Not Equal Republican or Democrat. And what I say to everyone is, to be evangelical does not mean to align with a party. And in fact, I don't care if you're a Democrat or if you're a Republican. What I want is, if you're a Democrat, be a prophetic Democrat. Be one that calls your party to align with the values that Jesus has, and what he really aligns with is the poor. If you're going to be Republican, align with Jesus, who aligns with the poor.
Lisa and Sharon Harper, thank you. She's the author of Evangelical Does Not Equal Republican or Democrat and executive director of New York Faith and Justice. Now we turn to Femi Okeh for a few headlines. Femi?
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. The president spoke just about 14 minutes ago in support of the failed rescue plan. In his televised address, he urged Congress to take action to pass the proposed bailout. House members will meet again on Thursday in another effort to agree upon a financial bailout bill. A widely watched housing index shows that home prices dropped to the fastest annual rate ever in July. Markets in Europe have rebounded after a slump in early trading. After a precipitous drop of 7% yesterday, the Dow futures are up 2%. U.S. nuclear envoy Chris Hill is heading to North Korea in hopes of reviving the country's disarmament deal. North Korea has started to reassemble a main nuclear reactor. And at least 150 people are dead after thousands of pilgrims stampeded today at a Hindu temple in western India. That's a look at some of your headlines making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In the first minutes of opening trading on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 190 points. An expected rally has taken place in response to the non-passage by the House of Representatives of the bailout plan, which was before the House yesterday. We're talking about the House vote against the economic bailout plan. Dominic DePinto wrote on our website at thetakeaway.org, it would be interesting if the House vote came in the spring rather than the fall. That's the time farmers are going to the bank to finance the next season. I wonder how the House Republicans from rural states would vote in that case. You can let us know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. At the opening on Wall Street, there was nobody to ring the opening bell after the very, very depressing historic drop yesterday. But they're not thinking about Wall Street down in the Texas Gulf Coast. When the Hurricane Ike tore through the Texas Gulf Coast, the region's 160,000 Vietnamese Americans suddenly knew where to turn for information. For 4 days, Radio Saigon Don Houston struggled to stay on the air despite power outages to keep Vietnamese Americans from Galveston to Houston informed. When the storm was over, the station was deluged by calls from listeners in the tiny town of San Leon, who did not know where to turn for help but soon found it. And the station found its mission changing from journalism to activism. And to share this exciting story, we're joined by Thuy Thanh Vu, a journalist and CEO of Radio Saigon Houston. You really understand the value of radio in a storm like that, don't you, Thuy?
Yes, we did learn a great lesson about life when we found ourselves become a basic need of life, just like electricity and water. People didn't realize how much they need the media, need information until they live without it.
Well, people forget, you know, here in New York, we've learned this again and again and again. When the lights go out, when the power goes out, when the cell phones go out, when the computers go out, when the wireless connections go out, there's always radio. It is absolutely the last line of defense. And how did you realize the responsibility that you had to take care of the people in Galveston and in the Texas area to keep them informed?
If you've been through that once, that experience once, then you would understand that way, why people need you. Our power went out about an hour before the storm, and we were left in the dark. And it was a very scary experience to know nothing about the outside world, to feel so lost and so you know, confused. You didn't know what to do. And we went through that experience. That's why we make the commitment that at any price we need to go on, because if we as a journalist felt that way, how would the people out there would feel like? And I felt that's the responsibility of the media to provide that need. People only need you when they are in crisis. Otherwise, they can have the media, they cannot have the media. But in time of crisis like that, you become their essential. You become their lifeline.
And a very special lifeline, Thuy, particularly for the many Vietnamese Americans, some who don't speak English very well and couldn't rely on anything but you at Radio Saigon for information as to what was happening. Describe the kind of phone calls that you got.
Oh, as soon as we got on the air, we went on the air half an hour late because we couldn't get the backup generator on. But as soon as our voice was heard, then all of our, in-studio phones lit up. And I called, and so I took a call, and a lady was so happy. She said, we've been waiting in the car next to the radio and waiting to hear, you know, some voice because we felt so lost. And then throughout the day, we got phone calls like that I would never realize. At some time, I forgot that we are in a radio studio. I thought like I am a 911 operator when the lady called in and said that a tree fell on my apartment and I have a single kids with me and I'm so scared what I'm supposed to do. What if we get electrocuted? And I asked them, why don't you call 911? They said that she did. I did, but nobody responded to me. Suddenly you felt such a bond with the listeners who trusted you so much to call on you in their emergency. So we have no way but try our best, and then we keep talking to them while our staff members try to call other people. But then some of the callers call in on the other line that said that we happen to live right near you. Why don't we come and pick her up and pick up her children until the situation was resolved. So in time like that, you felt like, oh, my God, we really made the change in people's lives.
Well, we're talking with Thuy Thanh Vu, who's a journalist and CEO of Radio Saigon in Houston. And you were sharing information from the community and you were disseminating information to people. Explain how, first of all, invisible you were in the local media in the Houston area. And secondly, how you helped people to understand how to negotiate the federal government, FEMA, and all the agencies that were out there to help your community, even though they didn't know how to reach them.
Yeah. we consider ourselves as the voice. We consider ourselves as the speaker to enlarge their voice, to make their voice be heard by people. The same thing happened to San Leon. Although I live in, we've been working here for a long time, but we never heard of San Leon. Honestly, shamefully confessing that we didn't know about San Leon until a caller called us and said that, how come we never heard you mention about us? We are the most damaged in between Houston and Galveston, and you cover all the area but not us. And then we investigate and we realize that San Leon is a small town of 4,200 of people, but we were caught in between the two giants, Kima and Tiki Island, are the high ends with high ends vacation homes and powerful people. San Leon is a fishing town. They call themselves a drinking, fishing town. And then we could understood right away how they felt, because a lot of times we felt the same way, being an ethnic media in between all the giant mainstream media. And so you connected that way. And we felt such a need, a struggle, at their fight become our fight.
Well, it's a great story. And San Leon, we should say, is 7% Vietnamese, and your fight got the information to them. Are you still on the air there, Thuy Thanh Vu?
Oh, of course. We are organizing a weekend. This coming weekend, we all will go down with all of the volunteers from our community to go down there and give them a hand, whatever they need.
Volunteer weekend in Galveston and in Houston, courtesy of Radio Saigon Houston. If you want more information, just tune in to Radio Saigon Houston. Thuy Thanh Vu, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thuy Thanh Vu is a journalist and CEO of Radio Saigon Houston that helped people in the Vietnamese community in South Texas deal with the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. News from that region, Houston reports this morning that three bodies were discovered this weekend in the debris in Galveston and Orange counties, where they are still cleaning up. Hundreds of thousand people still without power. 1 million people were evacuated from that area in the wake of Hurricane Ike. Also, market news this morning as we go to a break. 228. That's the upside movement of the Dow Jones Industrial Average this morning.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And we're going to turn now to the developing story about contaminated dairy products in China. Chinese state media reports that police arrested 22 people accused of involvement in a network that produced, sold, and added the industrial chemical melamine to milk. This comes as Thailand is tightening restrictions on dairy products from China. Joining us now from Hong Kong is BBC correspondent Vodine England, where yesterday British chocolate manufacturers recalled some Chinese-made products. Good morning, Vodine.
Yes, hello. Hi.
So what's the latest? The Chinese government has taken some people into custody?
Yes, indeed. They actually announced these arrests on Monday, but some of them now appear to have happened last week, but they didn't tell us about them then. They are of 22 people who seem to have formed a bit of a network in northern China, first of all producing this chemical melamine and then selling it to people who are also collecting milk from farmers, then putting it in the milk, and allowing that milk to then enter the food chain. And that's what they're being arrested for now.
So we're talking about 54,000 children who were made ill from this infant's milk that involved the melamine, and several children that died. Had any sense at all how many other products are out there that the melamine could potentially be in?
Well, it is quite worrying, actually, in many countries now around the world, particularly in Asia and Africa, where all kinds of Chinese-made products ranging from cookies, biscuits, up to milk formula, including chocolates and so on, all of them
are now being tested for how much melamine they may have in them. And certainly products have been discovered as varied as chocolate and biscuits in this part of the world, to milk powder discovered in Libya, for example. And all of these countries are recalling the product and banning further imports of anything that might have some kind of Chinese milk powder in it somewhere.
So it's certainly an evolving story, but you also get the sense that the Chinese government was suppressing this story as the details leak out slowly. And as you began with us this morning, arrests were made last week that they're only mentioning this week.
Well, yes, there's unfortunately nothing new in that in China. I mean, it is an authoritarian state and it can control to some extent how information reaches the public sphere. Having said that, there is a far more lively internet community these days, and certainly Chinese citizens are very angry at the revelations that seem to keep coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And there is still a lot of uncertainty as to who knew what and when did they know it. It is now officially admitted that the company where this scandal began, which is a company called Sanlu, that they, the company, already knew about melamine last December. There was then a whole lot of back and forth between the Chinese company and its foreign venture partner.
Which, of course, continues today. Vadine England, thanks for joining us. Vadine England is a BBC correspondent who comes to us from Hong Kong.
The scary thing about that story is it was deliberately added to pass quality tests. The contamination was all about passing quality tests. Oh, my God.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 30th. And Femi, okay, I think you'd agree it's been a busy news day. What do you got?
Oh, yeah, it certainly has. Good morning, all. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush had stern warnings for congressional leaders today after they failed to reach an agreement on the financial bailout plan yesterday. In a television address an hour ago, President Bush said the economic damage to the nation will be painful and lasting if Congress fails to pass a bailout bill. Congress is off for 2 days for the Jewish New Year, and talks will resume on Thursday on Wall Street. The markets seem to be rebounding after yesterday's historic drop. The Dow opened nearly 160 points. How are we doing right now, John, on the markets?
Yes, you want to know? The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 206 points off its highs of the morning, and the S&P is up about 1% at this point.
Great. Thanks very much.
You know, it had a record drop yesterday, 9% almost.
Yeah, yep. in points, absolutely. Barack Obama released a statement this morning urging Congress to get the financial bailout plan passed, and this comes a day after John McCain accused his opponent of partisan infighting during yesterday's bailout negotiations. Now, descriptions for the big bailout include a ransom note, a $700 billion bet, a $700 billion to keep CEOs in their office. I think you get the general drift I'm going. These are all Congress people's descriptions. And then there was Republican Congressman Paul Brown for Georgia's unforgettable description of the $700 billion bailout.
This is a huge cow patty with a piece of marshmallow stuck in the middle of it, and I'm not going to eat that cow patty.
He's a chef, sounds like. Mm.
A very good chef as well.
Right, yeah, sure.
I'll take the marshmallow and leave the rest. That's a look at your main news today. Of course, all about the economy.
Thank you very much.
You're
well,
very welcome.
The president spoke to the nation, as Femi mentioned a moment ago, about exactly an hour ago, and he was urging Congress to pass the bailout package and Americans to be reassured that this is the right thing to do.
The reality is that we're in an urgent situation, and the consequences will grow worse each day if we do not act. The dramatic drop in the stock market that we saw yesterday will have a direct impact on the retirement accounts, pension funds, and personal savings of millions of our citizens. And if our nation continues on this course, the economic damage will be painful and lasting.
But that's not what our listeners think in reaction to the president and in thinking about the House's failure to vote yesterday.
Hello, this is Al from Brooklyn, New York. I'm calling because I think it's very disturbing to hear you continually refer to Congress's failure to pass the Bush administration's proposed bailout plan as if it was somehow Congress's responsibility to do whatever the president asks. They chose to reject it. They didn't fail to pass it. There is a difference, and I would like if you would please note that. Thank you.
Duly noted, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So whether it's democracy in action or capitalism in flames, the markets are reacting this morning. And for more on that, we have New York Times columnist Gretchen Morgenson with us. Gretchen, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
You know, it seems to me that this concern about Congress and yet the global markets' apparently infinite faith in the dollar are fundamentally incompatible, and that at some point we can't have it both ways. It seems to me the passage of this bailout is all about restoring global faith in the U.S. economy. I just don't know how both can happen.
Well, I think that's a very good point. It's peculiar to me that the president says that we must pass this or, you know, there's going to be further bloodshed in the markets. Well, you know, I think that the opportunity now is to craft a better bill that people can, you know, respond favorably to. This was a slapdash measure, literally put together, you know, over a period of days and on 2.5 sheets of paper initially. You know, I think that's an insult to our intelligence, honestly. We need to know where the money is going, how it's going to be spent, how the toxic securities are going to be purchased so that we know we're not paying too much for them. You know, I just think that this was really sort of misbegotten from the outset, and so we now have an opportunity to do it right.
And some economists have said if we just let the chips fall where they may, that it would be a matter of months before bankruptcies and the private sector on its own would sort of shake out the institutional vulnerabilities and the market would begin to rebound and that the Federal Treasury would not be so exposed. Does that really wash?
Well, the problem is that banks do not have any capital, or they do not have enough capital, and a lot of financial institutions are strapped for capital, so they cannot come up with the money that's necessary to, you know, help stabilize the financial institutions that are teetering. Now, we saw last week Warren Buffett step in and buy a large percentage of Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs, in return, gave him a 10% coupon on his investment. Now, that's a sizable dividend for him to receive. But he's one of the few people out there who has money saved up for this awful rainy day that we're in. So, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of folks like that.
Gretchen, the president, when he spoke an hour ago or so, called this an urgent situation and said that the consequences could grow each day if nothing's done. And you take a look at the market this morning, and clearly it's early, but still up 2% already.
It is an urgent situation, but, you know, again, I question the urgency of putting forward a bill that had very few details and that some of the important details were sort of nuanced. Yes, it's urgent, but it has been urgent for many, many months. And I think that the taxpayers understand why is it all of a sudden have to be done in 2 minutes or 2 days?
And I guess that sort of feels like the contradiction is inherent. The president's saying one thing and the markets, you know, I mean, the world hasn't fallen apart today.
Well, the world is in very dire straits, and yesterday, I think, was a reflection of the, you know, inability to act and this infighting, you know, in Congress, which is nobody's idea of pretty. That's not good. You want to see leadership. You want to see strong leadership. But I think that this was, as I said earlier, this bill was from the beginning very weak, very vague, unspecified, and that's the problem.
You know, we've seen a pattern in the Bush administration of when things get rough, calling for traditional ways of doing things to be tossed out the window, whether it's the Patriot Act or national security issues, or in this case, running the economy, it kind of like a managed operation from the U.S. Treasury with the powers that were at least outlined for Henry Paulson that the Congress rejected. And here Congress is really sort of turning it back on its head and saying, no, 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 we're not going to do things that way. You know, last week you mentioned Buffett coming into the market and buying $5 billion of Goldman. You know, last week that was an endorsement of the financial sector. This week, it really looks like, what did Warren Buffett not buy? He didn't buy any of the stuff that the Federal Treasury is going after. He didn't go after WaMu or Wachovia. You could look at Warren Buffett's decision to enter the market as a real verdict on, hey, the only good stuff to buy is Goldman. Everything else is junk.
Well, don't forget, though, John, that he got 10%. So even Goldman, you know, having to pay 10%, that's well above the typical corporate rate, you know, corporate bond rate. So, you know, we're talking about a distressed circumstance there. So, you know, the 10% reflects a very, high level of interest for his investment. So, yeah, there is a lot of stress out there. There is a lot of distress on the horizon as far as the financial institutions are concerned. And that is absolutely clear. But we really cannot have just blank check provisions given over to the Treasury Department.
Well, in that sense, Warren Buffett and the Americans who are urging their Congressmen and women to vote against this bailout are on the same page. Gretchen Morgenson, thank you very much for joining us.
Anytime.
Gretchen Morgenson is assistant business and financial editor and a columnist with The New York Times.
We're always on at The Takeaway. Election Day is less than 6 weeks away, and we've got you covered. Check out vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
We've got a new tool, a couple of them, for following the candidates. We've got an Electoral College Prediction Tracker, which translates the national polls into Electoral College votes, which are crucial. We also have video from new voices across the country and much more.
And we're following the $700 billion bailout plan that was rejected by the House of Representatives yesterday and the after effects we'll see this morning.
Only 30% of Americans support the bailout. Are you one of the 30 or one of the 70?
Hi, my name is Ann from New Jersey. I think the generation born between the 20s and 40s has a better grasp on economics. They lived through the Depression. They saved their money. They didn't buy anything unless they could afford it. I don't buy anything unless I can pay for it.
All right. What's your take at thetakeaway.org?
Here's, you know what, John? This is The Takeaway, and we've had one heck of a morning.
Yes. 877-8-MY-TAKE is how you can tell us what to do with our money, or my take at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and it's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.